Plastic surgery as a medical specialty began 100 years ago during the First World War, and it was pioneered by Dunedin-born surgeon Harold Gillies. He treated thousands of men who needed reconstructive surgery due to war injuries, and later he trained two New Zealanders, his cousin Archibald McIndoe and Ramsford Mulden, in his techniques. Molam. I'm trying to read my own handwriting. It's not always easy. What Gillies, later Sir Harold, was doing was heroic reconstructive surgery on ghastly injuries, the like of which had rarely been seen before. Dr. Lindsay Fitzharris is a medical historian who has described this in a book called The Facemaker, A Visionary Surgeon's Battle to Mend the Disfigured Soldiers of World War I. She describes the book as an intimate account of the struggles that Harold Gillies and his team faced at the Queen's Hospital, and of the men who suffered the double trauma of injury on the battlefield and the painful process of recovery. It's also a fascinating medical history. I began by asking Dr. Fitzharris, what was it about warfare in World War I that caused these dreadful injuries?
Well, thanks so much for having me on the show. The nature of warfare at this time led to high rates of facial injuries. There were an incredible number of advances in artillery and weaponry at this time. So many, in fact, that a company of just 300 men in 1914 could deploy equivalent firepower as a 60,000-strong army during the Napoleonic Wars. Men were maimed, they were burned, they were gassed. Some were even kicked in the face by horses. Before the war was over, 280,000 men from France, Britain, and Germany alone would suffer some form of facial trauma.
What was the extent of plastic surgery before World War I? I know that rhinoplasty goes back hundreds and hundreds of years, right?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, plastic surgery certainly predated the First World War. In fact, the term plastic surgery was coined in 1798 by a French surgeon named Joseph Dussault. At the time, plastic meant something that you could shape or you could mold. So in this case, a patient's skin or soft tissue. That's exactly what plastic surgery means. But attempts at altering a person's appearance in earlier periods tended to focus on very small areas of the face, such as the ears or the nose, rhinoplasty being one of the oldest medical procedures on record. You don't really get attempts at the wholesale restructuring of the face until the American Civil War in the mid-19th century. And even then, it's not being done on a huge scale like it is during the First World War.
Why was rhinoplasty done so much so early? Was it something to do with the syphilis?
Yes. So if you have syphilis, I mean, now we can cure it with antibiotics, but if you had syphilis back then, it was incurable. And what would happen in the later stages of the disease is that your nose would tend to cave into the face, and it was called saddle nose. In fact, it was so prolific that there would be no nose clubs in the 19th century. All these people would gather together in London and they would celebrate the fact that their noses had fallen off due to this horrible disease. I talk about that in my first book, The Butchering Art, which is about Victorian surgery. But yes, you're absolutely right. Things like syphilis, people would get into duels, into sword fights. They would have injuries to their nose. Sometimes the nose would be purposely disfigured if you had committed a certain crime. And because of these reasons, too, oftentimes disfigurement was associated with criminality or with social diseases, so with morality as well. And that's why there's so much bias against facial differences on the eve of the First World War.
Interestingly, and this is a bit off Harold Gillies and the First World War, but back in the day, I think you say that it was considered immoral to fix, for example, a nose, because if somebody had a disfigurement, it was a sign of their sin, which could not be erased.
Yeah, that's correct. And so, as you say, it was a mark on the face and it was meant to warn others. You know, and this idea of evilness associated with disfigurement is still alive today. You only have to look to Hollywood movies to know that this is true. How many villains in movies are disfigured? You know, you have Voldemort, Darth Vader, you have Blofeld from the Bond movies. Harvey Dent in the Batman movies becomes evil after he's disfigured. You have Joker. I mean, the list goes on and on. And I don't think people are really aware of why those associations exist, but it does go back hundreds of years. And as I said, it's associated with social diseases as well as criminality.
Is that why these men who was so badly injured in World War One, had the double trauma, if you like. There was a shame attached to a disfigured face that may go back centuries.
Yeah, absolutely. This was it was believed to be a fate worse than death, which we know isn't true, but that's how a lot of these men felt. It was very isolating. In fact, when these men left the hospital grounds, they were often forced to sit on blue benches so that the public knew not to look at them. Their fiancés broke off engagements. And it was just a really hard time. I often say that this was a time when losing a limb made you a hero, but losing your face made you a monster to a society that was largely intolerant of facial differences.
So when the men got injured on the battlefield, take an example, and your book has many personal stories, individual stories of soldiers who got injured. Let's look at Percy Clare, for example. What was his literal journey from the battlefield to Harold Gillies?
Well, every man had a different experience, but I do open the book with Private Percy Clare, who gets shot in the face in 1917. The reason why I chose him was he wrote this extraordinary diary about his experiences. And in his case, it took hours just to get removed from the field. Sometimes it could take even days, because these stretcher bearers, the moment they stepped onto the battlefield, they became targets. And they often just didn't think that a face wound was survivable, because it's rather ghastly. And the face is very vascular. It bleeds a lot. Anybody who's had even a minor cut on their face will know this. So just getting off the battlefield was really difficult. And from that point on, there were multiple steps to getting evacuated back to Britain. And if you were lucky enough to get evacuated back to Britain, then you had to fall into the hands of Harold Gillies. So it could take many months sometimes. There are several cases where, you know, some of these men are sent to the wrong hospital, as I say. It takes over a year to get into Gillies' care. And of course, during that time, your wounds could get even worse. And the scars could get worse at that time, too. So Gillies sometimes had to unpick work that had been done close to the front and start over with the face.
Because the conditions that the men faced on the battlefield and in the trenches were, I mean, unhygienic doesn't even begin to describe it right. So the risk of infection was almost, well, it was 100% guaranteed, I would have thought.
Yeah, infection rates were high. Now, so we do know about germ theory at this point. And in fact, I address this in the Butchering Art, because there's a surgeon named Joseph Lister who introduces germ theory to medical practice.
Listerine.
Exactly. Recognize his name through Listerine, which he didn't create. It was named for him, but not by him. But weirdly, Lister's triumph in the 19th century does create some problems at the beginning of the First World War, because you have this new generation of surgeons who've grown up on aseptic and antiseptic techniques. And they're not used to identifying infections. And so at first they are, you know, suturing up these wounds very quickly to stop the hemorrhaging near the front. A lot of people are dying very fast. And so they just want to stop the bleeding. And in doing so, they are literally sealing these men's fate up, because they're suturing in the infection. So that was a problem early on. Also, you have to remember, this is before antibiotics. So the challenges were immense for someone like Harold Gillies, who was working with something like the face, where there was a lot of bacterial infection.
So there was no penicillin, obviously, and sepsis presumably would set in.
Yes. I mean, that was certainly a problem. They get better as the war goes on. And actually, this book is so much about the advances made during the First World War. You know, you have the birth of facial reconstruction and in plastic surgery. You also have advances in anesthesia. You have the first blood banks appearing in empty shell casings. And this is all wonderful. However, I did come to the grim realization halfway through my research that as wonderful as these advances were, they actually prolonged the war as well, because as doctors and nurses got better and better at patching these men up, they were being sent right back to the front, and it was feeding the war machine, and it was a vicious cycle. So I think that part of the story certainly has to be acknowledged, especially as we're seeing the return of old school warfare in Europe right now.
You mentioned the blood bank, which came after blood transfusions were developed. And that was something else. We will get to Harold Gillies in a moment, but the blood transfusions developed during and because of the war, and you have an account of the very first soldier to receive a transfusion.
Yes, that's right. I went down a bit of a rabbit hole with the blood transfusions, because
it's fascinating. There were many rabbit holes to go down.
Wasn't my editor was sort of always pulling me back from the ledge. And we had this kind of debate about whether the blood transfusion section should even make it into the book in the way that it ultimately did, because it was quite long. But the history of blood transfusions goes back hundreds of years, but it's really on the eve of the First World War that huge leaps and bounds are made, almost as if in preparation for this major global conflict that was about to happen. And as I said, you see the first blood banks appear in these empty shell casings near the front. So the advances at this time were extraordinary. It still wasn't being used to the extent that we would see it in later wars, but it certainly was there. It certainly saved a lot of people's lives. Gillies himself is performing these procedures as well at the Queen's Hospital that he establishes later in Sidcup. And sometimes, unfortunately, people would die from these blood transfusions too, because they were still coming to grips with, you know, the ins and outs of identifying blood types, et cetera, et cetera.
So the very first blood transfusion, was it in France?
I believe so. I have to go back into my memory banks now. You know,
whatever. They had two guys in adjoining beds, and they just fixed up a tube from one to the other.
That's right.
And luckily, they were compatible.
Yes, luckily they were compatible. And it was a real delicate surgical procedure, because you had to open up the veins and you had to insert the cannulas and the tubes and transfer the blood. So it was very difficult. You always had to have the patient sort of side by side until you get that concept of blood banking later in the war.
Many men arrived, I don't know how many, but some at least arrived to Gillies, first of all in the Cambridge Military Hospital in Aldershot and then Queen's Hospital, with a label, you say, saying G-O-K. What does that
yes.
mean?
GOK was God only knows. So technically, the nurses and the doctors were supposed to write down all kinds of information as they were evacuating these men out of the trenches, such as if they had a tetanus shot, et cetera, et cetera. But sometimes it was just impossible to know. And of course, these men, especially if they had facial wounds, couldn't speak. So it was difficult. The other challenge when evacuating a man with a facial wound was, at first, a lot of these well-meaning medics were placing these men on their backs. And what would happen is they would end up drowning in their own blood, or their tongues would slip back into the back of their throat because they were missing certain kind of anatomy. It was only later in the war that the official advice came down that these men should be placed face down on the stretcher.
And face down presumably also risked suffocation, didn't it?
I mean, if it was face down and your head was hanging over the stretcher, you had a better chance at surviving. There is a guy named Private Walter Ashworth who was injured on the first day of the Battle of the Somme, which was a terrible battle. Even if you don't know anything about the First World War, you probably know about it. Of the 100,000 British soldiers who took place in the advance that day, 60,000 were killed or injured, some of them very seriously. Ashworth is hit in the face, and in the process, he falls forward into a shell hole, and he lays there for 3 days, unable to scream for help because he's lost part of his jaw.
Oh.
But falling forward was crucial to his survival. So I always tell people that, you know, you might not think that he was lucky, but that was lucky, because in doing so, he didn't drown on the blood. He was able to breathe somewhat. And eventually he was removed from the field, and he did find himself in Gillies' care.
I mean, the terrible thing is that a lot of these guys wouldn't consider themselves lucky, because they could not deal with their injuries, even when Gillies had been at work for them. You talk about Corporal X, who told his fiancée that he'd fallen in love with another woman to save her from a miserable wreck like me.
Yeah, that was a horrible, sad story. So Corporal X, we don't know his name. It's told through an account by a nurse that was at the hospital. He's brought in, he's heavily bandaged, and he keeps saying that he needs to get these bandages off, these beastly bandages, because they're going to upset his fiancée, Molly. Now, at this time, Gillies banned mirrors from the ward and from the hospital, and he did that under the guise of protecting these men so they wouldn't get discouraged or shocked by their appearance. But of course, he inadvertently was also instilling in them a belief that they had faces that weren't worth looking at, which could be problematic later. But in that process, Corporal X actually smuggles in a mirror. And when his bandages are finally removed, he catches sight of his appearance and he's very depressed by this. And as you say, he ends up writing to Molly and saying that he met another woman in France. He lies to her to protect her, what he sees as protecting her from being attached to him. So there were sad stories like that, certainly. But we have to remember that, again, the facial biases of the time, that Gillies himself was a product of those facial biases, because arguably he really only had to go so far as restoring function, making sure the patient can eat or speak, swallow. But he was going way beyond that so that the face was deemed socially acceptable by the standards of its day. So he himself is a product of those biases, of the fact that a lot of people in society couldn't look at these men and accept them for their injuries.
So let's go to Harold Gillies. What was he doing immediately before the war?
So Gillies had come to Cambridge at the age of 18. He had lived his childhood in New Zealand. He came to Cambridge to go to medical school. He trained as an ENT surgeon. And when the First World War broke out, he volunteered with the Red Cross. He ends up going to France, and there he meets a very important figure named Charles Vladier. He's one of my favorite sort of characters, if you can call him that, in this book. He's sort of bigger than life. He's a French-American dentist. He has a Rolls Royce that he retrofits with a dental chair, and he literally drives it to the front under a hail of bullets. The guy was a total legend. And it was really Vladier who showed Harold Gillies this desperate need for facial reconstruction, and also demonstrated the importance of good dentistry when rebuilding a person's face.
And he looked at Vladier's early experiments with bone grafts.
That's right.
Which is really interesting. You've got an account of a Dutch surgeon back in the 17th century who became the first to describe the procedure when he documented the case of a Russian surgeon who had repaired a defect in a soldier's cranium by implanting a fragment of dog bone into the man's skull. The church said, no, we can't have this, and excommunicated the soldier. And when the man asked that the procedure be reversed, the surgeon discovered that his natural bone had grown around the graft.
Which is a really awful story.
It's an awful story, but it shows, I don't know whether you can describe that as a serendipitous discovery, but it was an important one.
It was important. And there were experiments with bone grafting in earlier periods. And I touch a bit on that in the Facemaker. And as you say, Vladier was doing all kinds of experiments with bone grafts at this time. And that was really important for Gillies to witness. So Gillies ends up adopting a lot of these methods that he's seen near the front and expanding on them. And eventually all of this becomes tried and tested and becomes standardized into practice, into plastic surgery. So when we say that Harold Gillies was the grandfather of plastic surgery, we might say that he was the grandfather of modern plastic surgery, because it just enters this whole new era.
Right. I mean, you know, it's often said, Newton's expression, standing on the shoulders of giants.
Exactly, yeah. But I mean, Gillies wasn't standing on many shoulders. There were no textbooks to guide him. And in as much as some of these procedures were, you know, done little by little in earlier periods, nothing had been done at a mass scale. Nothing in a scientific way where you could really try and test these methods and see if they actually worked. And also the damage to these men's faces was so extensive. It hadn't really been seen on that scale. You saw a little bit in the American Civil War. But by the time the American Civil War was over, fewer than 40 plastic operations had been completed on record. So very little had been done, really.
So Gillies signed up for the Royal Army Medical Corps in France and became a battlefield surgeon. And then he came back and worked at the Cambridge Military Hospital in Aldershot. And
that's
he volunteered, he was in his early 30s, I think.
He was, yes. So he gets, you know, kind of excited by this work he's seen Vladier do. He goes back to the War Office in London. He petitions to open a specialty unit at the Cambridge Military Hospital in Aldershot. The pencil pushers in the War Office didn't really see why there was a need for this. Of course, they weren't seeing these kinds of injuries coming from the trenches at that point, but they did grant permission for it. Gillies went out onto the street. He went onto the Strand in London. He went into a stationery shop and he bought labor labels, and he hand wrote and addressed them to himself at Cambridge Military Hospital. And then he sent those to the front. And within weeks, men began appearing at his hospital with these handwritten labels. So it worked. And eventually Gillies was overwhelmed by the number of men needing his help. And that was during the Battle of the Somme. And so he opens an entire new hospital dedicated to facial reconstruction, the first of its kind.
And tell me, who was on this multidisciplinary team that he set up at Queen's Hospital in Sitka?
Yeah, I mean, Gillies was really interesting because he took a very collaborative approach. There were, of course, other surgeons working on facial reconstruction in this period. There were surgeons in Germany, there were surgeons in France, but they tended to work solo. So what Gillies does is he brings on a whole team of artists and mask makers, radiographers, x-ray technicians, photographers, dental technicians, all kinds of people who were working towards the same goal to rebuild the face. One of these people was Henry Tonks. He's also one of my favorite, quote, characters in this book because he has a very domineering personality. Now, Tonks was a very famous artist in his own right on the eve of the First World War. He was also trained as a doctor. And Gillies recognized that the work he was doing at the Queen's Hospital was so important that there needed to be pictorial records of it. So what Tonks does is he actually goes into the operating theater and he sketches, you know, what Gillies is doing. And this is hugely important to be able to replicate this later by other surgeons. And he produces these wonderful portraits of these men, and they're all in color, and they really capture the humanity of these soldiers in ways that photographs can't.
I was going to say, why not photograph? Why draw or paint?
There were photographs, but of course they would be in black and white. So there are photographs in the face maker, which I decided to include. And I didn't do that lightly because I didn't want it to be medical voyeurism, the, you know, looking for the sake of looking.
The grotesque.
Exactly.
I haven't received the days of COVID supply chain problems, blah. I haven't received the bound version, the final version of your book. I've only got the unbound version. So no photographs. For which I'm sort of glad.
Right, yeah. But see, I think that it's important in 2022 we don't put these men on the metaphorical blue bench. We need to look at their faces. We need to reckon with what war does to the human body. But again, you know, there is that fine line. You don't want it to become medical voyeurism. Mm. So I consulted with a disability activist about a lot of this. Her name's Ariel Henley. She wrote a fantastic book called A Face for Picasso. She herself has a facial disfigurement. That's how she describes it. And, you know, we talked about language. We talked about the word disfigured because that might not be a word we use today. But
I was going to ask you whether disfigured belongs in the same basket as disabled these days.
Yeah, I mean, and actually my editors were a little bit uncomfortable with even disfigured on the cover. But the point is, these men were disfigured to the society they lived in. And I didn't want to lessen that. They had huge biases to overcome. It wasn't a facial difference in 1917. It was a disfigurement. So I think that the language is appropriate for this, although we might not use that term later or today. And then with the photos, you know, again, I included the photos of the men that are featured in the facemaker. I didn't go beyond that. Of course, Gillies had hundreds and thousands of patients. I really only include the photos of those who've been given a lot of context. We hear their voices and their stories in this book. But there is an exception. Any soldier who died in Gillies' care, I do not include their photos. I only put in their pre-injury photo and a surgical diagram of what Gillies was trying to achieve, because they never did get to complete that reconstructive process.
So when you say men who died in his care, not necessarily as a result of his care, of course, but these were experimental operations and he would have had failures.
Of course. And I think failure is very important to talk about when you're talking about the history of medicine and science, because oftentimes a lot of things fail before they work. And we need to acknowledge that part of the story. So I'll give you an example. There was a pilot named Lumley who crashed his plane on graduation day. He never even made it into battle. And he was severely burned as a result. And it took over a year to get into Gillies' care. So at this point, he's in very bad shape. You can imagine what happens to your skin when you've been burned and you haven't gotten the appropriate treatment for over a year. But the other issue was he was heavily addicted to morphine at that point. He was just in bad shape. And Gillies really wanted to put off the operation. He wanted Lumley to gain some of his health and strength back. But Lumley was also very depressed and he wanted to see results as quickly as possible. So he begged Gillies to operate sooner rather than later. Gillies gives in into him. He tries to lift a flap of skin from the chest to rebuild the face. And as a result, Lumley dies. This is personally a horrible, tragic story. And Gillies feels that failure very much. But it's important to acknowledge in this book because it teaches Gillies an important lesson. And it becomes a tenet, a principle of plastic surgery, which is never do today what you can reasonably do tomorrow. And when you're rebuilding the face, you often have to do it in small increments or the body will get overwhelmed.
And a lot of these men had, I don't know, one man you cite had up to 40 procedures.
Yes. I mean, some of these men underwent operations for over a decade. And, you know, they were very painful operations. And again, a lot of these men were going far beyond what they needed to so that the face was deemed socially acceptable to subject themselves to knife that many times. Some people listening will be familiar with the fictional character Richard Harrow in Boardwalk Empire, who wore one of these metal masks that some of these disfigured soldiers did don in the First World War. And these were wonderful on some level because they offered a non-surgical solution, but they didn't age. They were uncomfortable to wear. It was very hot. You're putting it over a wounded face. And for all of these reasons, it didn't really offer the long-term solution that many of these men were seeking ultimately. And I also like to remind listeners that these men were wearing the mask for you, not for themselves, because again, they would have been uncomfortable to wear, but it was really so that you would feel comfortable looking at them.
Interesting. You talk about an artist called Anna Ladd who made these masks, but none of them survived. I mean, they didn't have great longevity, the masks, did they?
Yeah, they were very fragile. I don't believe any of them existed, but you know, you never know when you start doing a publicity tour, someone comes forward and says, well, I had read a story of a man who died and the daughter took the mask and she shattered it because she hated it. She felt like it was a prison for her father. So again, although these things in still photographs look very realistic, and there's a lot of photographs of these masks out there, you just have to Google it. And they do look realistic. Remember, they're still photographs. So if you were sitting across from someone, it could be unsettling because it doesn't operate like a face. It doesn't move. And I think a lot of the men ended up really hating them. Gillies employed mask makers because while patients were undergoing multiple surgeries over multiple months and years, the mask could come in handy. And there was even a patient at the hospital who would go out into London and he would wear this prosthetic. And sometimes it would get too hot, so he would take it off. And when he came back to the hospital, he would hold up 1, 2, 3, or 4 fingers to indicate how many people had reacted negatively or fainted as a result of him taking that mask off. So it was very sad.
And were the masks standard issue? Were they modeled on photographs of the individual's face before the injuries or what?
Oh, they were highly individualized, which is why they took so long to create. They were expensive to create. So the artist would look at the patient's pre-injury photos and try to really rebuild the mask to look like the face before it had been injured. And everything, you know, the tone, the skin tone, everything had to be matched. They would even have mustache, some of these masks made out of real hair. They were extraordinary on some level. But as I said, a lot of times, you know, these men would say, you know, these blankety blank masks, you know, give us something we can shave. And it just didn't offer that long-term solution. So a lot of them ended up submitting to the knife in the end.
One can't imagine a more stressful job than the one that Harold Gillies had taken on. And yet you describe him as very kind, very caring, quite cheerful. Did he not feel the stress? Did he not take it on?
I think he certainly felt the stress. And there were some moments in The Face Maker where I show him breaking down. But you're right. He did. I mean, a lot of surgeons have gallows humor, and he certainly had that. He was a bit of a prankster, a bit of a jokester. He had this alternative persona called Dr. Scroggy, and he would dress up and he would bring oysters and champagne and he would gamble with the men, all the things that were forbidden at the hospital technically.
Dr. Scroggy.
With Dr. Scroggy. Why? And so it was, I don't know where he came up with the name, but he loved to dress up in this alternative persona and go in and cheer the men up with all the things that they technically weren't allowed to do at the hospital under the military terms. So he could be a really delightful figure, you know, and I think that lightness, that his ability to keep things light and to instill confidence in his patients really served him well, especially in what he was doing. And he developed lifelong friendships and relationships with these men. In fact, one of them, Big Bob Seymour, who lost his nose during the Battle of the Somme, becomes his private secretary and serves, you know, with him for the rest of Gillies' life.
I can't remember who it is. Maybe it was Percy Clare, whom we mentioned earlier, who describes the atmosphere at Queen's Hospital and compares it to somewhere ghastly that he'd been before, and said, you know, it was warm and cosy and cheerful, and there was a community of men, all of whom had, to use that word, disfigured faces, and consequently didn't mind, you know, because they were all in it together.
Yeah, and I think, you know, that was the brilliancy of the Queen's Hospital. That was sort of an unintended consequence of the Queen's Hospital, was that everybody was disfigured. So if you had had that facial injury, you were sent to a general hospital, you might feel a little bit self-conscious, you might not participate in any of the activities. But at the Queen's Hospital, everybody had that problem. And so, you know, they had sports days and theater days, and they, you know, you could learn a language, you can learn how to farm, you can learn how to barber, there were courses, you know, so it was really, you know, quite a community. And that was equally important to the rehabilitation of these men, not just the surgeries they were undergoing at the time.
I'm talking to Lindsay Fitzharris about her book about the Harold Gillies' work during World War I and reconstructing the terribly, terribly damaged faces. It's called The Face Maker. What was his modus operandi, Harold Gillies? How did he envision what face? You said that he wanted to make them socially acceptable, but did he refer to earlier photographs of the men?
You know, Gillies didn't necessarily have a goal in mind to return the men to their pre-injury status. He really let them control their identity. You know, he would go in and show them photos of other patients and say, what kind of nose do you want? So he didn't really necessarily want to restore the face as it once was, although he would do that if the soldier wanted that. But there was a lot of control the soldier had, too, in kind of creating this maybe new post-war identity.
And we should talk about some of the difficulties. We've talked about the blood transfusions. We've talked about the lack of antibiotics. What about anesthetic?
That was a real challenge. You know, anesthesia hadn't really progressed much since 1846 when ether had been discovered. So you're talking about a rag with chloroform over the face or a rudimentary mask with ether. And this was a problem, as you can imagine, if a face is damaged, putting a mask over the face could be quite painful and difficult. It also obscured the area that the surgeon needed to work on. There is a scene in The Face Maker where Gillies is leaned over a patient and the patient is breathing ether back into Gillies' face and he's getting wounded. And this is not a good situation when you're doing something delicate like rebuilding someone's face. So in parallel to advances in facial reconstruction and plastic surgery at this time, you also get advances in anesthesia. And in fact, it is Gillies anesthetist Ivan McGill who would go on to solve the problem by creating intratracheal anesthesia, which then you can bypass the mouth and the nose and the face, so to speak.
Sometimes he would draw an entire face on a patient's chest and transplant it whole?
That is mind-boggling. So one of the chapters opens with a journalist in the operating theater, and this procedure is going on. And as you say, he would essentially draw, you know, where the eye holes were going to go, and he would lift this chest flap over the face. It's mind-boggling to think about the body being able to heal from that and to adjust to it. And for Gillies to be able to figure this out, and, you know, plastic surgery wasn't just a scientific pursuit. It was a creative pursuit. To be able to visualize all of those moves. And again, people like Henry Tonks, who was working at the hospital, really helped Gillies also imagine how this could work, because they would create casts of these men's face, and then Gillies could work, you know, on the casts. He could think about his moves visually before he goes into the operating theater. It was really extraordinary.
I think that Gillies himself described what he was doing as a strange new art.
That's right. I wanted to call the book A Strange New Art for a long time, but my first book was called The Butchering Art, and I didn't want people to think that this was, like, you know, branded material. But he did call it A Strange New Art. And the title, The Face Maker, was really tricky, though. It took me years to figure it out. But at the very end, when I was writing the epilogue, I came across a letter written to Gillies congratulating him on his knighthood, and it said, "Dear Facemaker." And I thought, well, that's perfect. So I love the title because, you know, in the cover art too, if people get a hold of this book, it really illustrates that this is not just about one man, but about many men, because the cover art shows the silhouette of a Tommy and his face is made up of many different faces. And again, as much as this book is about Harold Gillies, it is also about these disfigured soldiers of the time.
Actually, looking at the cover reminds me of a point you make, that in the first year of World War One, they had no head protection. Helmets yes. only came later.
That was a real surprise to me as well. As you say, in the first year, there was very little protection really at all. And these men, sometimes really boys, they didn't know what to expect. I had read an account of a 16-year-old who joined up in, you know, enthusiasm. And he was asked whether he wanted to stay till the end of the war or he wanted to stay in the Army for a year. And he said, well, I don't want to stay in the Army for a year. I'll stay till the end of the war, because everybody just thought it would be over very quickly. So they didn't know what they were facing. They were being sent out into these trenches with very little protective gear. You saw the invention of things like the flamethrower at this time. Tanks were new. You know, they left crews susceptible to new kinds of injuries. And of course, you had chemical weapons as well at this time.
Chemical weapons that started with chlorine gas. Why did they stop using chlorine gas and go into mustard gas?
That's a good question. You know, I said at the beginning of the Facemaker that this is certainly not a definitive war history. And so I don't actually know the answer to why they switched. I'm guessing because chlorine gas wasn't as effective at killing, but I would have to check into that, why there's kind of the sudden switch to different. And also there was a lot of experimenting. You know, they were creating these weapons. They were just putting it out there. They didn't know what they were going to do. The flamethrower is a great example of that, you know, and it was so destructive and psychologically scary to see these kinds of weapons in action. In fact, chemical weapons were more psychologically damaging probably than bodily damaging, because they weren't used that often. But when they were used, it was so scary to these soldiers. And so, it, like I said, the psychological impact was very severe at this time.
This is more a philosophical question than anything else, but the terrible, terrible nature of World War One and its impact on the soldiers in the trenches. These days, we have become more accustomed to a more depersonalized sort of war, you know, long distance war, drones, where you don't have to deal eyeball to eyeball with the enemy. Do you think that the kind of warfare that took place in World War One is, well, obviously World War Two happened. World War One was not the war to end all wars. But do you think that war should be terrible in order to deter people from making it? Clumsy question, but do you know what I mean?
No, I know what you mean. I don't think anything is going to deter it. I mean, because we're, like I said, we're seeing the return of old school warfare in Ukraine at the moment. I'm over here in the UK, despite this very American accent. I've lived here for 20 years. And I remember just a few months ago, I saw a BBC correspondent on the news. Literally, there were dead bodies on the street. And I thought, this is shocking. But then I remembered that war photography is nothing new. It goes all the way back into the 19th century as well. And sometimes we need to see those images. And that's why I make such a case that we need to look at these men's faces in 2022. It's actually been very hard to get news outlets to run photos of these men in reviews, because we're still squeamish. We're still uncomfortable. But we have to get over that discomfort, first of all, because these men were hidden and they're valuable and their stories are valuable and we need to listen, but also because we do need to have a reckoning with what war does to the human body.
Let's talk about a couple of the innovations that Harold Gillies introduced. One of them was epithelial outlay, he called it. What was that?
So the epithelial outlay actually was invented by a Dutch surgeon, and what he does is he reverses it. So he calls it an epithelial inlay. And he uses this to construct the eyelids of a sailor named William Vicarage, who's terribly burned during the Battle of Jutland. And his face was completely destroyed, but his eyelids were gone. And it haunted Gillies that this man couldn't shut his eyes to the horror that he had seen. And so he wanted to come up with this solution. It's rather technical. And I have to say, you know, I'm a medical historian. I'm not a doctor. I did consult with a lot of doctors on the language, and we kind of had to work our way through this. And I don't want to scare anybody out there. You don't need to know anything about medicine or history. To pick the book up. But there was this kind of existential moment when the book was going into production and my editor said, "How did the eyelids close?" And I thought, oh my gosh, I don't know. And so I had to kind of go back into the records and try to describe this. And it is technical, but basically he creates an eyelid, and the challenge really is the inner structure to make sure it's lined with the right kinds of cells, and that, of course, that the eyelids can open and close. And he is able to do that for Vicarage, which is amazing.
How are you on tubed pedicles then?
I'm better on tubed pedicles now. You know, I've been doing so many interviews. I was in the U.S. on book tour recently, and the book made the New York Times list, which was really exciting because, you know, this story about a man that a lot of people don't know, they don't know his name, and about a war that a lot of people just don't think about these days could kind of elbow its way onto the list with all these celebrity memoirs. So when you're rebuilding someone's face, you can use grafts or flaps. And you can think of grafts as sort of the salami of plastic surgery. That's kind of a thin piece of material, whereas flaps are sort of the stakes of plastic surgery. It's a thicker piece of meat. So when people are missing various chunks in their face, you're going to need flaps. You're going to need something a bit meatier to kind of rebuild the face. Now, the flap would remain attached at one side to the blood supply, and traditionally it would remain open on one side so it could get infected. What Gillies did was he took it and he rolled it like an elephant's trunk and he stitched it together. So all of that inner tissue is encapsulated with skin. So you can take one of these flaps from your thigh and you leave it attached on one side to the thigh. You move the other end, the elephant trunk's end, to the abdomen. Once it attaches to the abdomen and forms its own blood supply, you can sever it at the thigh. You can move that side then up to the chest and so forth and so on. So you can waltz these tubed pedicles up to the face to rebuild it. So it was really ingenious. It was a game changer for plastic surgery, and Gillies was one of the first to do it.
He went on to private practice after the war and more cosmetic surgery for not only rich people, but including rich people. I mean, it was a very different scene, wasn't it?
Yeah. So after the war, he continues to operate on the soldiers because, of course, the war isn't over for them. But Gillies needs to expand his practice because plastic surgery is not a subspecialty of medicine. That's hard for us to imagine because now it's so dominant in medicine today. But it wasn't back then. So he moves into the cosmetic realm, and he was excited by those challenges because he said that reconstructive surgery is about returning something to normal, and cosmetic is about surpassing the normal. He also continues to do reconstructive surgery on congenital defects, on injuries. There's a story about how women, I didn't know this, in the 1920s were using X-rays to remove facial hair,
remove facial hair.
So horrible. And these women were getting cancer as a result. And so then there were surgeons that had to go in and remove this cancer. And of course, we're leaving the face disfigured. And so in steps Gillies to fix these disfigurements caused by this terrible procedure of removing hair with X-rays. So he continues to do reconstructive surgery. He moves into the cosmetic realm. He does both. He ends up operating during the Second World War. He introduces his cousin, Archibald MacIndoe, another New Zealander, to the strange new art of plastic surgery. And MacIndoe actually ends up becoming very famous for operating on the guinea pig club, the burned pilots of the Second World War.
The Spanish flu, of course, broke out at the end of the war. I wondered if that affected Gillies' business, his Queen's Hospital.
It was funny because, you know, I was writing this book during the pandemic, and I knew it was, you know, it was coming at the end in 1918, as you say. And I thought, how, you know, what were the challenges there? You know, so you had stories of some of these men who survived all of these surgeries to reconstruct their face, only to die then of the Spanish flu, which was really awful. We don't have that many accounts. We don't have really Gilly's account of how he handled it. Just that it was challenging. Some of his staff died from it. But yeah, just another horrible thing on top of an already horrible thing coming out of the First World War.
The other thing that Gillies did, of course, was to pioneer sex reassignment surgery as far yes. back as the 1940s.
Yeah, so he performs the first phalloplasty on a trans man named Michael Dillon. And Michael Dillon comes to him in the 1940s. So this is completed in 1949, very early, the first successful phalloplasty. And eventually
when
Michael Dillon...
When you say phalloplasty, you mean literally creating a penis.
That's correct. So he created a penis for a trans man named Michael Dillon in 1949. And this is a gender, what we would call a gender affirming surgery today.
And gender affirming or gender reassignment?
The sex reassignment is an older term. Now we call it gender affirming.
Right.
I actually worked with, I had trans.
It's a tricky area, right? I bet you had.
It is tricky. Yeah. And I had a trans activist read over the language to make sure that it was all up to date because it's always changing. And so now they do call it gender affirming surgery. Michael Dillon came to Gillies and asked that the surgery be done. That might seem odd to listeners, but actually Gillies was well placed to do this because he had been working on genital reconstruction of sailors who had been injured during the Second World War. So he was, familiar with the area. He was going to be using tubed pedicles to do the phalloplasty on Michael Dillon. And eventually the British press outed Michael Dillon. There was this horrible media frenzy. Dillon is driven from Britain, but Gillies really stands by him. And I think that speaks not only to his progressive nature as a surgeon, but also his progressive nature as a human.
So he was very determined. He was kind. Was he a maverick? Would you describe Gillies as a maverick?
Oh, absolutely. I think a lot of surgeons are, though. He was very competitive. And a lot of times, so in the Queen's Hospital, they had different dominions. They had the New Zealand unit, and they had the Australian unit and the Canadian unit. And what was fantastic about this was you had all these surgeons working at this in this hub, essentially. They were all learning from each other, and they were all very competitive. So standards rose across the board. And Gillies was very competitive himself. He was a maverick a bit. And as you say, there was an aspect of experimentation that I think we need to acknowledge during this time. If the guinea pig club of World War II, if we can call them the guinea pigs, I mean, certainly these men in World War I were the original guinea pigs.
But a certain amount of badgering was required on his part. You talked about how he sent labels out and back to himself in order to get the men back. He had to badger and badger to get this off the ground.
Yeah, absolutely. And again, even after the war, of course, he had to make a case for plastic surgery. A lot of the surgeons who were working at the Queen's Hospital returned to their old practice. They didn't necessarily pursue plastic surgery as a subspecialty of medicine. So he was always making the case. He was always pushing forward. He was always pushing the boundaries. And, he's really responsible for the birth of modern plastic surgery. And, people today will say, well, plastic surgery is about, facelifts. And it's a vanity project. But again, Gillies did move into the cosmetic realm, but also we need to recognize that plastic surgery is a heading, and underneath you still have reconstructive surgery as well as cosmetic. And those continue both to be very important to the practice of plastic surgery. So lots of surgeons still doing reconstructive surgery for people who are injured or have congenital defects.
You mentioned the competitive nature of the work. And when we were talking about the tubed pedicles, I was thinking about the argument that broke out about who actually invented them.
There was a surgeon at the Queen's Hospital who worked with Gillies, and he claimed that he had done it first. And he really tries to put forward this argument in the Lancet, and he can't get over it for years. I think even decades, he kind of continued to hold this grudge against Gillies. I have looked at all of these case notes, and I have to say it was Gillies who did it first. And Gillies seemed to be quite perplexed as to why his colleague was so adamant that he was the first. But beyond that, there was also a Russian surgeon who had at the same time or around the same time had created this similar technique. So I always say that the tube scooped pedicle was sort of evolutionary rather than revolutionary because it came out of great need. And because of all of this stuff going on with World War One, it was sort of bound to happen. Someone was going to come up with it. So you had these simultaneous surgeons working independently of each other, coming up with very similar solutions to this problem.
What was his catchphrase? Don't worry, Sonny.
That's right. He would say, don't worry, Sonny, you'll have as good a face as any of us when I'm done with you. And he really instilled that confidence. And I have to imagine that when he would say this to these men, he didn't necessarily believe it himself, because as you will see, if you pick up the face maker, the damage on the faces is extreme, to the extent where you wonder how someone can survive that wound in the first instance. So it must have been scary. No textbooks to guide him, you know, and having to go into that operating room to be confident on their behalf, to make sure that they felt confidence in him. So it was kind of fake it before you make it.
This is a terrible question in many ways, but do you think he felt that he and indeed they had nothing to lose?
You know, it's a good question. I don't think so. I mean, he really felt the deaths of his patients when he would lose them. And there's a couple of instances in the face maker where he does lose patients. I don't think that was the case. He never set out with the, you know, idea that, well, this person's going to die. I mean, he always wanted to be able to save and transform their lives. And he really was able to do that in the end. You know, Private Ashworth, who I talked about, who laid on the field for 3 days after the Battle of the Somme, his fiancée broke off their engagement. But then later he marries another woman. And when he goes back to work, when he's discharged from the army, his boss makes him work at the back of the shop so that he doesn't frighten the customers, which is really awful. And I think one of the themes of the face maker is that not all wounds are inflicted on the battlefield. But much later, Ashworth goes to Australia. He runs into Harold Gillies, who is there visiting, and they catch up. And Gillies offers to have another go at his face. He wants to see if he can improve his appearance. And for whatever reason, Ashworth declined the kind offer. And I said in the book that perhaps he had finally made peace with the face that he had been given so long ago. So you can't really overstate what Gillies was able to do for these men.
As you said, your previous book was The Butchering Art, Joseph Lister's Quest to Transform the Grisly World of Victorian Medicine. Now you've done the Harold Gillies revolution in plastic surgery during World War One. I feel like you've got another book coming.
I do. Well, it's not coming soon, but my next book is going to be called Sleuthhound, and it is about Joseph Bell, the surgeon whom inspired the character Sherlock Holmes. He was Conan Doyle's professor, so it's going to be a fun romp through Victorian forensics and crime and all the things that we used to do in the 19th century. So I'm looking forward to getting back to the 19th century. And I just want to add, because of the New Zealand link, Harold Gillies has a very famous great-great nephew named Daniel Gillies. He's a Hollywood actor. He's been in The Vampire Diaries and The Originals. He's from New Zealand. And I just joked on Twitter that he should read the Audible book, and he agreed to do it. So he actually narrates the audio version of this book. He's got that New Zealand accent that I love, that I imagine that Gillies would have had as well. And it was great fun engaging with him with the story, because of course he did know about Sir Harold Gillies a bit, but I guess I was told that he would pause occasionally and say, oh, I didn't know that about my ancestor. So it's been a real joy to see him bring the story to life in his own way through the audible version of this book.
Lovely to talk to you, giving us so much time.
Thank you.
And that was Dr. Lindsay Fitz-Harris, author of the book called The Facemaker: A Visionary Surgeon's Battle to Mend the Disfigured Soldiers of World War One. Loads and loads of feedback on that, I'm hoping.